This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. What do you do when your elderly next-door neighbor is demanding a little too much help from you and driving you a little crazy? Or when your father-in-law has an annoying tendency to drop by in his loud motorcycle before waking hours? Or when the bride of a wedding you attended chose only to send thank you notes to those who bought items that were actually on her wish list? Some of us might turn to a friend or a spouse or a therapist, but many Americans will write a letter to Dear Abby. A team of journalists dug through three decades of Dear Abby letters to figure out what gets Americans annoyed over the years, so annoyed that they seek help from an advice column. Ilya Blinderman is a journalist engineer at The Pudding. That's an online visual essay and journalism website. Ilya, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And Caitlin Ralph is a junior journalist engineer at The Pudding. Caitlin, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, they worked on the story, 30 Years of American Anxieties. Ilya, what led you and your team to tackle 30 years of Dear Abby?
So I think a year or two ago, I'd come across a newspaper column that mentioned that Dear Abby is one of the longest running advice columns in North America. And we specialize in taking a data-driven approach to cultural topics. So as soon as I heard that there's a large kind of treasure trove data out there, I thought, you know what, this is perfect because we can examine this and we can potentially glean, get an understanding of what it is that has bothered people in America throughout the years. And that's not really something that's ever been examined before, I think, at this scale.
And Caitlin, what were some of the key themes that started to emerge as you tapped into what Ilya called that treasure trove of data about our anxieties?
Yeah, we definitely saw that there were certain groups of people writing in. So if you go through the article, you can actually see that it's split up into husbands and wives and sons and daughters. And then the certain letters were also about those different groups of people as well. And some of the themes that we pulled out were like sex-related letters. There were some about LGBTQ issues, some about religion. And again, you can see that broken up in the article as well.
Yeah, the visualizations are great. Ilya, one thing that stood out to me, we really freak out about our weddings here in the United States.
Yeah, we do. I guess regardless of who you are, it tends to be a very big event, whether you're the father, the mother, whether you're about to get married. And there are a lot of interpersonal tensions that fly about during a wedding, which I think is the reason why this was such a frequently noticed category.
And another one, and maybe on a more serious note, Caitlin, this is one that changed over the years. There was a stretch back, especially I think it was in the 90s, where HIV and AIDS questions came up a lot. When did you see that peaking? What kind of things were people asking?
Yeah, definitely. That definitely happened, you know, when it was like in the news and it was like, you know, at the forefront of whether an American was actually like directly affected about it, but they were seeing it on the news every day. So there are a lot of people writing in, some people who were like actually going through it themselves, but also who had just like general questions about it as well. So yeah, I agree. That was a really interesting portion of the data that I don't know if we necessarily expected going into it, which is probably one of the most exciting parts of analyses like this.
And Ilya,
yeah, just to,
go ahead, yeah.
To jump onto that, I was going to say there's a little bit of a peak in the, I guess, the late 80s, around 1987, when a lot of people were hearing about HIV/AIDS, but weren't really sure how to handle it. There were sons telling their mothers, you know, you can't be friends with someone who's HIV positive, and the mothers were writing in to ask Abby, is this okay? Is my son overreacting? So there was very little awareness, I think, in the general population. And people turned to Abby, and she educated a huge swath of Americans as a result.
One of the category headings that I like the most, and I think this was just for sons and daughters. It wasn't there for, like, the husbands and wives. Odd questions that Dear Abby got, and boy, they were all over the map. Haunted houses were some of them. I don't know, Caitlin, were there odd stories, odd questions that stood out to you?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, one of the illustrations that we showed, it's actually at the top of the article, was the husband that was like super obsessed with his new pet monkey. So I think when you're asking about like odd ones, that definitely was kind of at the top of the pile. What about you, Ilya?
Yeah, the husband who refused to sleep with his wife because he was having so much fun with a monkey was one. There was another one that I liked where a woman was writing to Abby to find out if she had any suggestions for spell books because she wanted to cast a spell to break up her daughter and her daughter's girlfriend, which is, I guess, in the 90s, not a very typical motherly activity.
So as we wrap up, I'll ask both of you this. Having read through all of our anxieties and weird questions for 30 years, and we all have our issues, Ilya, do you feel like, in context of what you've seen there, maybe your life feels normal by comparison?
Yeah, I mean, it really kind of puts things into a perspective a little bit. The fact that people are struggling with so much and have no outlet but to reach out to an advice columnist makes you feel very much grateful for what you've got. So it was certainly appreciated on my end.
And Caitlin, the kind of your window into people's souls here, what did it do for you?
Yeah, I think I definitely agree. I think like the idea of writing into an advice column, I'm a little younger, so that's like very kind of like an old archaic thing to me. So I think that was actually like a really interesting aspect of it for me, like that kind of like, I guess I say old fashioned type of communication with the newspaper. So I think that was one of the most interesting parts of going through this data.
We'll leave it there. Caitlin, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
And Ilya, thanks for sharing that with us. We've been talking to Ilya Blinderman and Caitlin Ralph. They write for the website The Pudding. They joined us to talk about their interactive piece, 30 Years of American Anxieties. You can find that at pudding.cool or linked at WPR.org. Researchers at UW-Madison are developing a bandage that could speed up the time it takes for a wound to heal. Looks like a normal bandage, but it uses small electrical pulses that could be powered by the natural movement from a person breathing. Still in the testing stage, not available in a store near you yet. Shudong Myang is a professor of materials science and engineering at UW-Madison. He's one of the lead researchers on the team working on this bandage. Shudong, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Okay, now, first of all, describe how this bandage works. It's different than the bandage I pull out of a box at home.
Right. It's quite different. So it's still a bandage, but this bandage has two components. One is an energy conversion component. We call that a nano generator. It will convert small skin movement into electrical pulses. And another component are dressing electrodes. Those electrodes can be placed on top of the wounded area. So the pulse electric field will be applied on the wounded area and facilitate the wound recovery.
All right, well, let's break this down a piece at a time because it's new to me. I didn't know, I guess people have been doing this, using electrical current to help wounds heal. That is a thing that works. I didn't know this.
Well, yes. I have to say, we are not the first one to fund this. Mm-hmm. People, you know, decades ago, people know electric field can facilitate wound recovery, but usually it's in hospital they use a huge machine to apply strong electrical field, high frequency signals to for the treatment. So our take is we make this very portable, wearable device, make it really daily care device, and probably our signal and our device is may have better treatment efficacy.
Right. So you, as you're saying, what people have done is a higher current, a higher voltage, more electricity.
Yeah.
This is a lower dose, and you're thinking that is going to work better. Why is that?
So we did some research on that perspectives. So we found if the electric field is strong by normal electronics devices, the current will go through our body, and this will oxidize certain species in our body and generate reactive oxygen. So this could be damage to the cells.
But these could be cancer causing things, ultimately.
Could be, yeah, could be. But our device, we are just a pure electric field with very limited amount of electrons staying on the surface without passing through the body. So this one should only do the good thing to facilitate the cell reconstruction.
All right. So a little bit of electricity can help us heal faster. How much faster? Do we? You've tried this in mice or rats so far?
We tried it in rats. Yes.
And so how much faster are these rats healing with these electric Band-Aids, bandages?
Right. Yeah, actually, this is a big surprise to us. So we thought it may have some effect, but this effect is a phenomenon. It reduces the time from 2 weeks into 3 days.
2 weeks into 3 days.
Yeah.
That's huge.
I would love to
heal that much faster.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's get back to part one here. You know, those devices you mentioned in hospitals, they're plugging it into an outlet of some sort. Uh-huh. These bandages are generating electric field from what? Just the way I would move around?
Right. Just it's a mechanical energy converter. So it doesn't have any battery, any additional power source. It just converts the small movement, mechanical movement, into electrical pulses.
So I'm a micro generator. Actually, no, you use the word nano generator.
Nano generator, yeah. Right. That's what we do during the last 10 years.
So I don't need to plug into anything.
No.
So ultimately, you've done rats. You're moving on to pigs next. Is that right?
That's what we're trying to do, yes.
Okay. And so ultimately, we want to end up with humans, presumably. Right. So what would this look like? What would I go to, I don't know, a store or a pharmacist or a hospital and get?
My envision is the eventual device will be just very similar to the normal bandage that we have, but with the additional small, very tiny component attached to it and with some electrodes. Once you put it on, it will significantly enhance the healing rate.
Now, you're doing this one step at a time. If the next stage of testing in pigs go well, then it's humans. Like, how long potentially could it take to have these available for human use, non-experimental human use?
I think it depends. How soon the experiment goes. Actually, we are trying to do the pig experiment and the human skin test pretty much in parallel. So we propose 3 years. Hopefully by that time, we'll have very strong evidence and show it can be moved to the human.
Let's take it back, yeah, to these bandages. Is this real rare material that you're using? Is this something that's going to be super expensive based on what you're making it out of?
No. I think that's another good merit for this device. It is made by a normal flexible device. It could be made from fabric or could be made from polymer. They just need some capability to attract electrons from metals, for example.
And who has expressed interest in this so far? What are people looking to use this for and in what settings?
Well, I think this will certainly generate a lot of interest from a wide variety of people. What we did right now is for the acute wound. I think the bigger potential could be the chronic wounds that are much harder to heal anyway. So I think that will generate much better impact for clinical use or for those patients who has diabetes that has a chronic wound suffering from those things.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really interesting work.
Thank you very much.
That was Xudong Wang, professor of material science and engineering at UW-Madison, with us to talk about his project creating a wearable electric bandage powered by the human body. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder has been pushing forward to try to secure an agreement with pipeline transport giant Enbridge before he leaves office and his Democratic successor takes his place. The deal involves a 4-mile-long section of pipeline that lies on the floor of the Straits of Mackinac, where Lakes Huron and Michigan come together. The pipeline, known as Line 5, transfers oil and natural gas from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario. Originally laid in 1953, there's been pressure from all sides to do something about the aging lines. Possible solutions have included shutting it down completely, creating a new one, or finding other transportation options. Dan Egan is a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel and a senior water policy fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. He's the author of the book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and with another book in the works, I understand. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've talked to you about Line 5 before. Tell us a little bit more about its history and what it's doing.
Okay, yeah, it was, as you just mentioned, it was built in, I think it was 1953. And, you know, it was built specifically to carry Canadian crude oil to refineries in Sarnia, Ontario, a little northeast of Detroit. And for the first 2 years, I believe, of this oil coming in to the Great Lakes Basin at Superior, it was picked up by a specially built fleet of boats and carried, crude oil carried on the Great Lakes, across Lake Superior, down the St. Mary's River, down the length of Lake Huron, and to Sarnia. And I don't think anybody was really happy with that situation. So this pipeline was conceived and built as a safer solution to floating this oil on all this fresh water.
So here we are, 2018. There's this part of this pipeline that runs under this part of the Great Lakes. What condition is it in? What do we know about its future?
You know, it depends on who you ask. If you talk to the pipeline owners, they say that, you know, it's built for the ages and it can last indefinitely. But, you know, common sense tells you that anything that humans build will break eventually. I mean, a bowling ball is going to eventually break. So I think it's naive to think that this pipe can run forever. That said, the pipeline owner, Enbridge, has been doing more intense maintenance on it in recent years, but that's because of public pressure. I mean, people were really pretty oblivious to the fact that this line was even there until Enbridge had a pipeline rupture in the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, and it was the world's worst inland oil spill disaster ever. I think it was a $1 billion cleanup, and that focused attention on the pipes running through the Great Lakes region, and it really focused attention on this pipe on the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac. It's actually two twin parallel pipes, and you know they're old, they're aged, and in some places their protective outside coating has been eroded. I believe one of them was nicked by a boat anchor from a freighter. I think that was last year. And even Enbridge itself has said that the line has, I think it's a 1 in 60 chance of failing between now and, it was like within the next 30 years, because of an anchor strike. And then an anchor strike happened. So yeah, they're a risk. And there'll be a risk as long as they're down there. On the other hand, we need oil.
Now, here we are. Election day happened. The Republican governor, Rick Snyder, in Michigan will be replaced next year by a Democrat. And there's a deal in the works now. What are they working on?
Yeah, okay. So I think even Enbridge now realizes that they can't keep these pipes lying. They lie exposed on the bottom of the lake bed. And so they've proposed building a tunnel underneath the Straits. Now, the Straits the Straits of Mackinac is like a place like nowhere else in the Great Lakes. It's where Lakes Michigan and Huron meet, and it's about 5 miles wide, and it's just churned by currents that can flow east some days, west some days, north some days, south. It would be a horrible place to have an oil spill. And so to address this problem, Enbridge has agreed to pursue a tunnel underneath the Straits. Now, they haven't done the engineering for this yet, and it's going to be quite a feat if they can pull it off, because I believe the Straits are over 200 feet deep in places, and you're going through bedrock. And I think the estimated cost for this is like $500 million. And now critics will say it's never going to happen. What it's going to do is buy time for Enbridge to keep running this 60-some-year-old pipeline system. And, you know, every day it's running is the day that they're making money off of it. So the governor, the outgoing governor, is on board with this tunnel plan. And I believe the incoming, the governor-elect, isn't so keen on it. And so they're trying to get a deal put together before the new administration takes over that would pretty much, you know, cement plans going forward for this tunnel.
Talking to Dan Egan, author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, about this Line 5 pipeline that brings oil from Ontario through Wisconsin, Michigan, back into a different part of Canada, and a chunk of it that runs under the Great Lakes, the Straits of Mackinac, older pipeline, trying to figure out what to do to maintain it, replace it, or find alternatives, Dan. And now let's look at those. Some people don't want the old pipeline. They don't want the new pipeline. As you say, there's still demand for this oil. What are the other options for transporting it, if not via an older new pipeline?
Well, you know, a big question that's never been, you know, precisely answered is how much of this oil running underneath the Straits of Mackinac stays in the United States, and because it goes back into Canada, a good percentage of it, I think it's a majority of it, and from there it can go onto the world market. So an argument against this pipeline is that, you know, these Great Lakes states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, we're being asked to take the risk for the economic benefit of a Canadian corporation. If they were to plug the pipe and the pipes and to keep that oil flowing, it would likely mean more oil coming through Wisconsin. Now, you know, a lot of people don't realize, but Superior is just like it's oil central up there. Some 2.5 million barrels a day flow into the city of Superior, mostly from Canada, some from North Dakota, and from there about 2 million barrels a day runs through Wisconsin, and another 500,000 or so runs through the UP and across the Straits of Mackinac. So if you want to plug those Straits pipelines, it's probably going to come through Wisconsin, and that means, you know, well over 100 river and stream crossings, and you know it goes through neighborhoods, it goes under people's driveways. It's unseen, but it's becoming much more of an issue for the people who in the communities that live astride of this pipeline corridor.
And then the other options for transporting oil include, as you were saying earlier, they used to be on boats on the Great Lakes. A lot of downsides there. Train, other forms of overland transport, are those looked at as better alternatives to an oil pipeline?
You know, pipelines, it's all how you assess the risk. I mean, in some ways, pipelines are safer. They have fewer accidents, but when they have accidents, they can be significantly worse. I can't see this oil going on boats, not only because it's an economic or ecological risk that, you know, few people are willing to take, but the lakes freeze and, you know, oil delivery needs to go around the calendar. So that doesn't really seem like a viable option to me. You know, going through Wisconsin would, you know, on a map it makes sense, but talk to the people who live along these lines. And, you know, they're already putting up a significant resistance to expanding the capacity on one of the existing lines. There's several lines that run through Wisconsin. And Enbridge is looking at, they opened up a line, I think it was in 2009, and it originally carried 400,000 barrels a day or so. And they've been ramping up the capacity. And, you know, there's a lawsuit going on in Dane County over insurance with Enbridge, but they're you know, planning to put 1.2 million barrels of oil through that pipeline a day soon.
Let's go back down to that pipeline across the Straits of Mackinac. You mentioned those churning currents that can go either way on a given day. What are the fears? What would be the consequences of a substantial leak in this pipeline under the waters of the Great Lakes?
Well, you look at the Michigan license plate, and it's the Mackinac Bridge, and it's the Straits of Mackinac. It's just a real iconic location. It's where Mackinac Island is. It's not far from, you know, some of the most spectacular beaches in northwestern Michigan, Sleeping Bear Dunes. And, you know, oil and water obviously don't mix, and oil and fresh water in the world's, you know, largest freshwater system, it's a dicey proposition. And, you know, Wisconsin is not on the sidelines of this issue. There's been studies done, and the currents could carry any kind of an oil spill westward toward Big Bay de Noc, which is really the northern arm of Green Bay. It's basically, you know, not far from Door County. And then if you imagine if this happened in the winter, you know, when the lake can be under 2 or 3 feet of ice, how do you respond to that? I mean, I don't even think they could, you know, figure out how much had spilled. If it happens in the middle of the winter, let alone, you know, get booms out there to scoop it up. And also, depending on the grade of oil, it could just sink and coat the bottom of the Great Lakes.
You mentioned Wisconsin not on the sideline when it comes to risk. Have we been in the game in terms of planning for the future of Line 5 and this pipeline that goes under the water?
You know, it's really interesting because Michigan's got its issues with Enbridge, specifically Line 5, and with their Line 6 that cracked back in 2010 and spilled into the Kalamazoo River. Wisconsin's got issues with Enbridge ever increasing the capacity of its existing network running the length of the state. And Minnesota's got issues with Enbridge building a new pipeline that will and flow into Superior. So these are all related, and the states are all kind of having their own squabbles with Enbridge. But I don't know if you know, our leaders are looking at the big picture, and the big picture is that there's, you know, a lot of oil coming into the Great Lakes Basin, and it's got to get through it one way or the other.
One objection from climate change groups is that these pipelines, they say, are in effect climate change enablers. By allowing the oil to flow, they encourage us to use the oil, boosting climate change. They're wanting to see more alternative energy. Is there any notion that this demand for this oil that's flowing through these pipelines, Dan, could go down?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's beyond my expertise, but you know, I think most people would agree that we are heading toward, you know, a future with electric cars. And, you know, these infrastructure projects that they're building are built to last for decades. And you got to wonder, is the demand going to be there in 2050? You know, the pipelines are going to be there.
We'll leave it there. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dan Egan, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and senior water policy fellow at the University of Wisconsin Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. He's the author of the book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. He joined us to talk about the plan for the Line 5 pipeline that runs from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario, and goes under a little piece of the Great Lakes along the way.